Hello everyone and welcome to JTalk Short Corner, the mini pod that keeps you up to date with events in J3 of the J-League. I'm your host Mike Innes and in this episode I'll be continuing a series of three pods taking a club by club look back at the season just finished. Let's get straight into things, focusing today on six teams in the central part of Japan, starting with Matsumoto Yamaga, the big club that infamously were relegated from J2 at the end of 2021. And it felt like it was a trauma for Yamaga to find themselves in the bottom division with an infrastructure and a fan base so much larger than that of any other club in J3. Hiroshi Nanami was kept on to oversee the operation of bouncing straight back, and pre-season, personally, I felt he and the front office hadn't done enough to trim the squad and focus in particular on solidifying the defence. Nevertheless, a scrambled injury time winner in the first game of the season at Kamatamari Sanuki gave Yamaga a huge confidence boost, and with a strong core of the team based on Victor in goal, Yuya Ono at centre-back, Paulinho pulling the strings in midfield, and the young live wires Yusuke Kikui and Ayumu Yokoyama in the more advanced roles, Matsumoto were second in the table at the halfway point of the season. Having by then scored 7 goals, despite spending time away with the under-19 national side, Yokoyama was emerging as Yamaga's young star, his pace, mobility and opportunism making him a feared opponent for J3 defences. But things unravelled during the second half of the year as Nanami struggled to deal with the mid-season departure to Renofa Yamaguchi of captain Takayuki Maya and to find a way to incorporate striker Lukao as he worked his way back to fitness. Meanwhile, Yokoyama and Len Komatsu were missing chances they previously would have put away. And it was a combination of those things which meant Matsumoto could never quite keep pace with Iwaki and Kagoshima United. And 4 losses in the last 9 matches, including a disastrous 1-0 home defeat to bottom side YSCC Yokohama, saw them end up 4th. Gabriele Anello and Kondrai both ask where Yamaga go from here and if they might find themselves stuck in J3 longer term. Nanami has quit the club, who say they are introducing a new organisational structure to provide improved support to the first team, with former Japan under-20s coach Masahiro Shimoda in charge. Shimoda's reputation as a club coach is based to a significant extent on his work with young players at Yamaguchi, but Matsumoto's circumstances now are very different from those at Renofa when Shimoda was in charge. Can he play his part in turning round the club culture and galvanising the whole organisation after a period of sharp decline? More broadly, can we regard with confidence the front office's ability to make good decisions in the light of their recent track record? There may be some small signs of regeneration at one larger club under discussion in this episode, but I don't see them yet at Matsumoto. Katare Toyama were another team who went into the season with their eyes firmly on promotion. Experienced coach Nobuhiro Ishizaki aiming to improve on 2021's 4th place finish, an ambition boosted by the signing of the division's top scorer Shota Kawanishi from FC Gifu and all-round central midfielder Arthur Silva loaned from FC Tokyo. Given Ishizaki's propensity for rotation, especially among his forward players, there were questions about how he would manage the options available to him. And the answer to that question early in the season was not well. 4 points from the opening 5 games meant Toyama were always playing catch-up. The back three of Makoto Lindo with new signings Shoma Kamata and Ryuya Ohata was finding it hard to gel, and when Ishizaki did make changes to the defence, his team lost 4-1 at Kagoshima. A run of victories against lower-ranked sides helped Katare move back up the table. Two goals by super sub Yuhei Ono, ironically perhaps the only front player with a really clear role, giving them a win over Vanrare Hachinohe that placed Toyama fifth at the halfway stage. But they were never able to push on from there, never rose higher than fourth, and always seemed likely to lose winnable games. After one such fixture at Azul Claro Numazu, Ishizaki stood down, head coach Michiharu Otagiri taking over for the remaining nine matches. There was a small new coach bounce, but when Katare were completely outplayed by Fujieda My FC, their chances of going up all but disappeared. They clearly were not as good as Iwaki, Kagoshima and the other sides that occupied the top positions throughout the season. Some good individual performances from goalkeeper Genki Yamada, best 11 selection Lindo and, when they were fit, Arthur Silva and Daichi Matsuoka masked the fact that Katare didn't play like a team and didn't look like a team that understood what their coach wanted. Toyama were one of a handful of J3 clubs to include foreign players in their squad, and Kanazawa Dreamin asks for a view on how they were used by Ishizaki and Otagiri. We certainly saw glimpses of Arthur Silva's quality, but he was never fully fit and neither coach used him in his more familiar central midfield role. Indeed, Otagiri sometimes played him as a striker to no good effect. Mateus Leiria is more difficult to analyse. Ever since coming to Toyama 18 months ago, there's been a nagging sense that somehow he had more to offer than the club were able to get out of him. Ishizaki ran out of patience with his ineffectiveness, but Otagiri put Mateus Leiria straight into the starting lineup and was rewarded with 5 goals in the remaining games. It'll be interesting to see if he stays on with Otagiri remaining in charge for next season. Two lesser-known players to finish with, forward Luis Enrique made only 3 brief substitute appearances and, on being released at the end of the year, indicated he planned to return to Brazil for surgery. And there's rookie midfielder Gabriel Enrique, who didn't get a look-in under Ishizaki but was used as a particularly dynamic substitute by Otagiri, but who very unfortunately ruptured knee ligaments late in the season and isn't expected to be back until May. The road to J2 for Fujieda My FC began in July of 2021 with the appointment as coach of Daisuke Sudo. Under previous incumbent Yasuharu Kurata, the team were going nowhere fast, achieving mediocre results playing colourless football. Sudo put the focus on attack, and although My FC during the second half of 2021 were always likely to concede, things were stabilised via a 10th place finish. The Sudo project gathered pace over the close season when he strengthened the base of the team by signing 3 players from J3 champions Roasso Kumamoto. Goalkeeper Kei Uchiyama went on to be in the J-League's best 11 for 2022. Keisuke Ogasawara and Taisuke Mizuno became vital performers in central defence and central midfield, respectively. Not that Sudo relied solely on bought-in experience to bring about improvements, as Keigo Enomoto emerged as one of the rookies of the year, Akiyuki Yokoyama and Masahiko Sugita enjoyed career-best seasons, Tojiro Kubo fulfilled much of the promise of his debut campaign in 2021, all those players taking advantage of the attacking framework provided by the coach. it wasn't all plain sailing. My FC experienced a slow start embedding new players into Sudol's 3-4-2-1 system. Striker Tomoyuki Doi did not provide the hoped-for goals and ended the year being released. But Fujieda manoeuvred their way into the promotion race, took advantage of downturns in form by Matsumoto and Kagoshima, crushed Toyama to climb into second place in round 29, and then did enough to hold on and seal their first ever move to J2. That's a brief rundown because there are more questions from pod listeners about MyFC. J Football Analytics asks for a general impression of Daisuke Sudo as a manager. I think he's been very impressive and is a deserved winner of the J-League's Coach of the Year award. To achieve promotion with, let's not forget, a small J3 club, he bought well, he improved the performance of players already in the squad, he inspired a steely determination to gain points Fujieda would previously have lost, and, above all, he won matches playing attractive football. To my mind, there's little doubt if MyFC hadn't got promoted, Sudo would have moved to a bigger club on the basis of what he's achieved. Questions also from Gab Anello and Condry. Gab asks, which is the bigger surprise, Fujieda's promotion in 2022 or Iwate's in 2021? Condry wonders if this success has come out of nowhere or if there's something lasting building at Fujieda. Difficult ones to consider, but I'll say Iwate's is more of a surprise, but Fujieda's is more deserved. They're a better side than Gruja and have won promotion playing in a more difficult division. It's undoubtedly something Sudo has built over a period of 18 months, and I think MyFC give the sense of having a more coherent development plan than Iwate, with derbies against Shimizu S-Pulse and Jubilo Iwata to look forward to. Just down the road from Fujieda, Azul Claro Numazu spent a proportion of the year consumed by concerns about their stadium, knowing they were required to raise money for and install improved floodlighting in order to retain their J3 licence for 2023. The possibility of an imposed demotion loomed very large over the club. A combination of local government lobbying and an online crowdfunding campaign did, however, pay dividends, and Numazu will indeed keep their suitably illuminated place in the division next season. On the pitch, too, it was a difficult year, although Masataka Imai's team did get off to an encouraging start. Early wins over the likes of Gidawants Kitakyushu and AC Nagano Paseiro helping them to a very respectable 9th in the standings by round 8. Mid-season, however, Azul Claro suffered the hammer blow of star striker Ryo Watanabe leaving the club for immediate neighbours Fujieda, and the rest of the campaign served to demonstrate how important a player Watanabe was. It's not that he necessarily scored a host of goals, but he did provide a focal point for Numazu's attacking play, and with Watanabe gone, there was no one to step into that space. Coach Imai took the blame, perhaps unluckily dismissed after a 4-2 loss at YSCC. Promoted from among the club staff, Kazuhito Mochizuki was initially appointed caretaker and soon afterwards got the job on a permanent basis. But despite trying all sorts of combinations of front players, he never managed to put together a credible J3 attack. Mochizuki won only one game against Toyama, inevitably 1-0 at home, and in the 18 matches after Watanabe left, Azul Claro scored only 9 times. The team gradually slipped down the table to end the year 15th. But let's look for some positives. Tetsuya Anzai is a decent overlapping right back in a 4-4-2 system. Young keeper Hiromu Musha had a good season following his move from Iwate, ensuring that Numezu had one of the better defensive records in the lower half of the division. Rookie Haruki Toyama brought energy to the midfield and will be hoping to get more starts in 2023. And on loan Malaysian forward Hadi Fayad at last had some J-League minutes to talk about with his 109,000 Instagram followers. He made 3 substitute appearances over the course of the year. It was announced before season's end that Mochizuki would step down, with legend of the Japanese game Masashi Nakayama returning to the club as coach for 2023. Numazu conclude this year in fairly dire straits. No money, a pretty uncompetitive team, confirmed by Fujieda's promotion as very much the 4th-ranked club in Shizuoka Prefecture. But they do have their license, and next year they go again. Talking all those months ago in the preview pods about FC Gifu, I quoted one Japanese commentator as saying the club's strategy of appointments and signings was risky. Gifu had come out of 2021 with a coach who'd been unable to make a team or impose a clear system, and lacking good young players to put pressure on underperforming veterans. The club prepared for 2022 by appointing a coach who couldn't make a team or impose a clear system, and by doubling down on the signing of underperforming veterans. That same Japanese commentator would later upgrade their view of Gifu's approach from risky to ridiculous. Just as a recap on some of the people involved, Toshiya Miura was appointed as coach at Gifu, having arrived at the club a few months previously to work as technical director. Miura added to an already ageing squad a further string of older players, the bigger names including Tomoya Ugajin from Urawa Reds, Kobe's Junior Tanaka, and Yoshihiro Shoji from Kyoto Sanga. J3 watchers were also intrigued by the signings of Kosuke Fujioka from Tegevajano Miyazaki and YSCC's Charles Unduka. The sense that Miura had assembled a disparate collection of individuals rather than a squad of players within which everyone had a role to play moved into sharper focus as Gifu began the season with defeats in 4 of their first 7 games, by which time the front office acted either hastily or quickly and decisively, depending on your point of view, to show Miura the door. All those contracts, all that money, and the guy overseeing the whole thing was gone within 2 months of the season starting. Miura's assistant, former Tochigi SC and Nagano coach Yuji Yokoyama, quickly took over, and at first he appeared to have pulled the squad together and provided a welcome sense of direction as Gifu embarked on a 7-match unbeaten run which saw them rise to 5th in the table. Whether this bred overconfidence or not, the next fixture at home to FC Imabari saw Gifu put on a performance of monumental sluggishness, Marcus Indio and company squishing them to the tune of 5-0. And from there it was downhill all the way, Yokoyama's team somehow winning only 3 matches during the whole of the rest of the season, as the high-profile names faded from relevance, only a handful of their teammates emerging from the debacle with any credit. The heroic Fujioka almost counterbalanced the 3rd worst defence in the division by scoring 16 goals, while on-loan winger Ryo Kubota coupled his lightning pace with work rate. Gifu 2022 was a bad plan, poorly executed, their supposed stars ending the season in 14th place, an extraordinary 30 points off promotion. Gabanello asks if they can do worse than this, saying it's hard to imagine, but... Actually, although Gifu haven't confirmed the identity of Yokoyama's replacement, early signs for next season are encouraging. A lot of those older players, not all, but a lot, were quickly released and, whisper it quietly, they're making some astute-looking signings. Are Gifu making themselves one to watch for our 2023 previews? Finally for this week, the enigmatic Gainare Tottori, about whom Kanazawa Dreamin gets to the heart of the matter when he says Tottori had some eye-catching results in the second half of the season. What stopped them from doing that sort of thing more consistently? Those results included a 3-0 win over Toyama, a 6-0 trouncing of Kagoshima, and a 4-0 away defeat of YSCC, all of which served to raise Kim Jong-song's team up to 12th in the table, with the division's joint third best attack and its second worst defence. The background to all this is that Gainare came out of 2021 knowing they had severe problems with their defence, but only limited means to fix them. Kim pinned all his hopes on bringing to the club Kosuke Masutani, who had won J3 with Kim at Ryukyu in 2018, but after then had suffered multiple serious injuries. Good experience, but perhaps not the most reliable. Having not played a J-League game since the opening round of the 2020 season, Masutani unsurprisingly took a while to bed in at Tottori, who early in the season also had much of the defensive part of the side out injured. Highly rated youngster Yusuke Ishida, captain Kōki Ishii, and key central midfielder Hiroto Sese, to name but three. Improvement of that back line was therefore slow, but it did happen in time, coupled with players elsewhere in the team growing in effectiveness and helping them to develop further as an attacking threat. Rookies Mun In-ju and Ryusei Takao both caught the eye with their speed, directness and willingness to shoot. Ryosuke Tamura came up with 5 goals and 5 assists from the left-hand side, while loanee Ryuji Sawakami contributed 7 goals and latterly some excellent link-up play. The one to watch at Gainare was expected to be Yuya Taguchi, who emerged in 2021 seemingly with star potential. But somehow Taguchi couldn't find an effective position in the team and his impact was greatly reduced. Step forward instead, Daichi Ishikawa, the focal point of a Tottori side which found its voice in the second half of the season, during which he found the net on no fewer than 12 occasions. Gainare didn't have the squad depth or luck with injuries to be consistently successful, and I've already mentioned in these review pods how rare it is to find a J3 side which is always able to show up and be on the front foot and aggressive. Tottori certainly can't do that, but at their best, they were one of the most attractive teams in the division. Ishikawa and Tamura on the flanks, always a danger. The likes of Mun prepared to make runs from deep. Yu Okubo prolific up front before he too was injured. Gainare struggled too much during the early months of the season to make their way into the top half of the table, but they emerged from 2022 with some credit, which has already resulted in other clubs picking off a number of their players. Looking ahead, though, Kim has given himself something to build on. In the third and final review episode, I'll be looking back on the seasons for Kamatamari Sanuki, FC Imabari, Ehime FC, Giramantz Kitakyushu, Tegevajaro Miyazaki and Kagoshima United. Questions welcomed on those clubs via the usual means. But with all the week's business seen to then, that's it for this mini-pod. All that remains is for me to say, Thanks for listening. Enjoy your football and see you next time. Bye for now.